Hi, I'm Taylor Smurl, and I'm an experienced bartender.
And I'm Tommy Smurl. I'm an experienced drinker.
He's my dad, and together this is...
Neat! A weekly booze cast.
With history lessons, trivia, and a twist.
So pull up a stool to the bar and join us for the lowdown on your highball.
Hello and welcome back to the show. Hey, Dad, how you doing?
Hey, Taylor, good. How you doing?
I'm doing all right, doing all right. Did you have anything good to drink this week?
Well, I didn't do a good job being inventive. I kind of fell back on my old reliable that I've fallen in love with, the espresso martini. Had some of those. Turned Sydney on to it. She never had a martini before that she liked. So I said, well, I'll make you a martini that you'll like. And I made her one of these, and she did like it.
Oh, well, that's nice.
So she said it's the first martini I've ever had that I liked.
Well, you know, not actually a martini. Just uses the name. But that's all right.
It's an imposter?
Well, we talked about this. The martini refers to a specific cocktail. A lot of things that were put in martini glasses started being called martinis in the 70s and 80s, like the appletini and, you know, whatever, chocotini and espresso martini.
Well, I put hers in a coupe glass, when I made mine, I made about a triple batch and put it in my good old coffee thermos cup. With the ice.
I would say of all the martini imposters, I would say that the espresso martini it gets a pass. It's good enough that it gets a pass.
Well, good. And then I didn't want to go too heavy on them. I had to save enough there so that I could give Sydney the one she wanted. So I switched over and I went to beach beers.
What's a beach beer?
Well, those are ones I brought back from the beach when we went. You always have to buy some cans so you can take them down by the beach or by the pool. You don't want to take bottles. So I bought a case of Yingling cans, and I don't think I ever drank any of them. I think the whole case was still sitting there at the end of the week, so I didn't want to throw them out. So I brought them back home, most of them, not all of them, what would fit in the cooler. And I stuffed them in the beer fridge, and I never had any occasion to drink them until last night. So that was, two or three months.
That's fine. They don't go bad, right?
No, actually, that was the 1st of August, and this is this 1st September. That was only a month, so, yeah.
That's good. I like a beer like that. I feel like that's a good, for me, it's usually Tecate, but that's just like, it's like a no thoughts only beer. Like, I don't want to think, I don't want to be impressed by the flavor. I just want a cold thing in my hand. And I want to drink it and then say, yep, that's a beer, and that's it.
Yeah, other than IPAs, you can find those in cans pretty readily. But other than IPAs, you know, just your standby regular beers are about all you'll find. You can't find any real good craft beers or something like that in cans for the most part. Most of them are in bottles.
Well, that's probably because of where you are, because that is a lot of breweries do cans, like craft cans. In my neck of the woods, but they are out there, I promise.
Well, that was a South Carolina Walmart, so
that's understandable.
Actually, it was Harris Teeters, whatever the hell that is, or Teeters Harris, or something like
I think
that.
You had it right the first time.
Harris Teeters.
Yeah,
okay. I'd never heard of those anywhere else. I don't know what that is. If I hadn't seen the store to know it was a grocery store, if somebody said, you want to go to Harris Teeter's, I'd have said, I don't think so. That don't sound right.
they had a pretty good wine selection, though, oddly enough.
Yeah. Yeah, they didn't have a good beer selection, though. Yeah. Well, what about you? Did you have any good beverages this past week?
Well, I got to visit Riley for her birthday down in D.C.
She's
there. Not too bad of a, it's like a 4-hour bus ride, but not too bad. Closer than she's ever been.
Yeah.
So I went down there and we had some sake. It was her first time drinking sake. So that was nice getting to share that with her. And, we went to a brewery. We went to a, Really nice place for dinner. Had a couple good cocktails.
Well, good.
Yeah, it was a good. Nice. There's a. I don't know much about the drinking scene in DC, but I've heard. I know some bartenders that work down there, so I know there's a good cocktail programs down there.
Yeah. Well, maybe over the next 3 years, while Riley's in law school, you'll get a chance to find out about it.
A little bit. Get accustomed to it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's in a nice neighborhood where she's at.
It is. It's a really nice neighborhood. A lot of cute places that are walkable, which is always, I don't know. I mean, however good your public transportation is, I just always prefer to live in a place where I want to be able to walk.
Yeah.
I want to be able to walk to a bar, and I want to be able to walk home from a bar safely.
Well, when we went up there and moved her in, you know, I had my car parked for 3 days. We walked everywhere we went. I just, you know, we drove there, I parked the car, and then, well, there was a lot of moving and parking in between, but it wasn't to use the car. It was just to get it out of a place I couldn't park to a place that they wouldn't tow me.
Yeah, it's funny because, I mean, I feel like, I live in a big city, but really I live in a small neighborhood. Like, I walk to my job. I walk to any restaurant I'm going to go to, any store. It's like pulling teeth to get me to go somewhere that I can't go on foot.
Yeah.
I live in this specific, like, 10 block radius of Brooklyn, and I don't exit out of there any, you know, it's got to be a real special occasion.
That's right. Well, that's what you're used to.
Well. But the topic for this week's episode, I was talking to a friend last week about they were saying that they like bitters, they like Amaros, and they want to like something like a Negroni, but it's a little too much for them. And if there was something like that, but not quite as heavy, and I was suggesting some alternatives. They're sort of along the same lines. But my first recommendation was just a white Negroni, sometimes called a Negroni Bianca. But have you ever heard of a white Negroni, Dad?
Never have.
I've heard of
a Negroni.
Yeah, Negroni classically is Campari, gin, and sweet vermouth, equal parts. White Negroni is just sort of a very basic swap on that. It's still gin. In place of your sweet vermouth, you use like a lighter aromatized wine. It's usually Lillet. And then in place of your Campari, you use something called Suze.
Suze,
which of course led my friend to ask, "Well, what is that thing? What is Seuss?"
And I was what I would ask.
Yeah, well, you know, like it was one of those bottles. I've worked with it before. You know, I've picked it up plenty of times, and I was like, well, it's a bitter. It's a floral bitter. It's yellow. I think it's French. And its flavor is mainly gentian. And the next question, of course, was, well, what is gentian? I was like, oh, well, all right.
Now I'm in over my head.
I've gone to the end of my knowledge line. I should be able to answer these questions more efficiently. So I figured we could kind of two birds, one scone this topic.
Yeah.
It's two birds, one scone, because we don't want to stone birds. We want to feed them scones.
You don't want your birds to be stoned, huh?
No, you want to feed them scones. I thought we could talk both about Suze, the liquor, and also about gentian, which is the main flavor in Suze. And also, as a long history, pops up in a lot of spirits you might be familiar with. Pretty important in the sort of bitter flavoring family. So I thought we could start there, since gentian predates Suze in usage pretty significantly.
All right, but I'm going to have to fight the urge to yell Suze every time you say it, because we just did Suzical the Musical this past summer, and you know, oh, the things you can think when you think about Suze. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da, Suze. So that's what I'm going to think every time you say Suze.
Well, you can think that.
Okay.
You can shout that too. I can't stop you.
Suze.
You're far away from me.
Suze.
I don't know. I don't know the cross section of people that are going to appreciate this alcohol podcast and also will appreciate some sort of obscure musical theater references, but I'm sure they're out there.
Oh,
they're
yeah. There's got to be some alcoholic musical lovers out there.
Well, I think there are a lot of those. I don't know specifically Suzical the Musical. But all right, so to get things started, what is gentian? Well, it's a plant. It's a flowering plant. It's a big family. It's about 400 species in its genus, with natural habitats largely found in temperate regions in Asia, Europe, and the Americas. But it can grow in lots of different places. And it produces large trumpet-like flowers. They're often an intense blue, but they can also be other colors, often yellowish, sometimes red or white. The cultivation and use of gentian for what else? Medical reasons goes back to antiquity.
Strictly medicinal reasons.
Yeah, it's another one of those. That's why we started using it, because it was for medicine, like most things that end up in alcohol.
And do they use the flower or the root? What is the component that they use of it?
It is largely the root that is used.
Okay.
Yeah, the root has all the magic properties.
When you describe the flower, it sounded like something that would be fun to grind up and use, you know?
It would probably be very pretty. I think you could probably garnish, probably. I don't think there's a lot of, like, available gentian flower garnishes on the market, but it sounds lovely. I saw a lot of pictures of it. It's a very lovely flower.
Yeah.
But the root... And the usage of it, that was the discovery of that was attributed, actually, where we get the name from, to an Illyrian king named Gentius, who ruled from 181 to 168 BC. So long, long time ago.
Boy, I'll say he was a Gentius giant.
This was if you're trying to put a map in your head, this would have been in modern day Albania. And King Gentius actually appears on modern-day Albanian currency. So, fun fact.
Hmm.
So King Gentius was the first to discover the curative properties of the root, and thus it was given his name. Those medical uses that I mentioned, really up through time, it was everything. Urinary tract problems, infections, muscle pains. They would pack it into like a poultice to draw out animal poisons, inflammation, abortions, helping to slow bleeding. And not just around the Illyrian kingdom. It was all around the world. It pops up in ancient Chinese medicine, Iranian medicine, Austrian medicine. The flower became an important symbol for the politically powerful Minamoto clan in Japan during the Heian period. So all that to say, it definitely found a place for itself in many cultures.
Wow. I should have gotten some of that and started taking it so I wouldn't have to have my knees replaced.
Well, about that. So for its medical actual efficacy... most of the ways I mentioned were probably at best placebo effect. There's really only one proven medical benefit of gentian, which is, if you remember on our flavor episode, we talked about the tongue and what different flavors do, sort of how they interact with our brain body mechanisms.
Right.
So if you remember from that episode, we talked about specifically bitter components. Chemicals that produce bitter taste on our palates are often our bodies associated with poison. So that causes our saliva production to pump up, our digestive juices to increase, because it's the body is basically like, oh no, we're ingesting a poison. I need to get this out of my system as quick as possible. Or in some cases, it triggers the vomit reflex, puke it up. So bitter tastes do actually have an effect on our body. You acclimate to them over time. The more you ingest bitter things, the less you're going to react to them, the less offensive they're going to be. But that trigger of our digestive enzymes, our salivary glands, is something that it is still capable of producing in you, and that is why it is useful as a digestif.
Well, I remember when we did that episode, the thing that I learned the most out of that was that you have taste buds in your throat. I never knew that. I thought they were all on the tongue and that there were different segments of the tongue that tasted different things, and that's all wrong. But
no.
Having the taste buds in the throat, though, might be why when you do drink something bitter, you kind of taste it like last in the back of your throat a lot of times, it seems.
Yeah. Well, and I guess you could surmise that those were some of the last to acclimate, because, when you're a kid, you put something in your mouth that tastes bitter, you spit it out. Over time, your taste buds get used to bitter, but those, you get to the point of actually consuming the thing, you're hopefully your tongue is acclimated.
Yeah, you haven't been swallowing it, so it's, it was like a premature evacuation.
No. I'm going to leave that there as if I never saw it. So, to the drinking end. All right. So as I mentioned, the roots were the part that they would be used. They would be dried and, like, steeped like a tea for their medicinal reasons. So it wasn't really until the advent of distilling culture that we start getting proper gentian spirits. In fact, like many words we've come across that, like, well, it means this, but it can also mean this. But then if you're here, it might mean everything. Gentian's sort of one of those in that it can refer to the root in its usage, but it can also refer to a very specific type of schnapps, which, hey, we just talked about schnapps.
I didn't know that. It's a schnapps too, huh?
It is a schnapps. And it's the schnapps in the style that is very clean, very pure. You're just using the gentian root, possibly with like some grain neutral spirit, but no additives, no sweeteners, no nothing. It's just very much pure gentian flavor. And this is something you'll run into around the German Alps. It's also sometimes called Enzian, which is just the gentian in German. And that dates back to around the 1600s. It's very dry, bitter spirit. And still popular in production in those regions today. So you don't hear much of it in, like, on the international level, but it's a very popular thing in the regions it's made in.
And they shoot it like a shot and schnapple it up.
Snap it, schnapp it, shoot it. Yep.
Snap it.
All the same. But it was really in the 1800s that gentian started to find its way into popular usage in numerous ways. You know, one of our go-tos here on the show and in cocktails is Angostura bitters.
Absolutely. That's my favorite. That's one I use in most of my drinks.
Well, and a lot of times when I tell people how Angostura tastes, I mean, yes, it's bitter, but I describe it as having a baking spice flavor because that's kind of all the other nuances going on. Mm-hmm. But that bitter quality to it actually comes from gentian. Gentian is a very important ingredient in Angostura.
I never knew that. I never looked at the ingredients on Angostura. I just took it for granted.
Yep. I think it's still, the patent is still out there. It was made for a long time. Now I think Coca-Cola owns the rights. But there was a cola called Moxie, which was launched, we're talking like mid-1800s. And it was sort of viewed as like it was alcohol-free, but it was a soda, also sort of an energy drink. And it promised to combat paralysis, insomnia, and the softening of the brain.
The softening of the brain? Well, I need that.
I don't know what that really means.
Do they have proof? Do they have laboratory proof of that?
No, and it definitely didn't do any of that, I would say.
Back then, they were very loose about what you could say about anything.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they knew the gentian did stuff. It did something. I mean, maybe...
It tastes like medicine, so therefore, it is medicine.
I guess if the cause of your insomnia was your poor digestion, maybe it would help a little. I don't think it would help the softening of your brain. But it is the origin of the word moxie. You know, I assumed it was the opposite. Like, moxie was a term for, like, I don't know, gusto or something. And then that soda was named after that. But the soda actually inspired that phrase of, like, oh, that boy's got a lot of moxie. Like, that's...
Wow, I never knew that. I would have... Gentian soda. I would have thought it was the other way around, too.
Yeah.
He's got a lot of moxie. We're gonna have to rub him out. You know what I mean? We're rub him out.
Got a lot of moxie. Must have really good digestion. Must have a very settled stomach. That's really what that
and
means.
And a soft brain.
No. Oh, nice hard brain. I don't think that sounds better. All right, but of course, we're in this same century, specifically 1889. That's the year where we get where Seuss hits the shelf.
Seuss, da 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 da.
Yes,
that's the thing about Seuss.
It's time to think about Seuss. Seuss. So Seuss, like a lot of spirits, has a bit of a conflicted origin story. Now, and this sort of goes to my own confusion on it. On the bottle, you'll see it's a product of France, and it is of course, currently made in France. And on the website, if you go to get the origin story, it will tell you that it is the creation of one Fernand Moreau. His story is basically he inherited a family distillery, but it was on the brink of bankruptcy. So he decided, you know, he kind of looked around at the trends of the day. Everybody's sipping on like wine-based aperitifs, but in the summer, if you want to ice these, they get a little too watered down. You know, they're not the strongest things in the world. So he thinks to formulate a new, stronger, bitter aperitif that can sit well over ice in the hot weather. And he, you know, does this with his, he has a business partner that works with him. And the two of them come up with this new aperitif that capitalizes on the rising popularity of gentian and is a little bit higher alcohol. And they first marketed it as picotin, which translates to a measure, I think like a little bit, you know? But then he changed the name to Suze in 1898, which is either inspired by his sister-in-law, Suzanne, or there's a river in Switzerland called the Suze. So
I don't buy either one of those because he was French. Why would he name it after a Swiss river? And why would he name it after a sister-in-law? You might after a sister, but not a sister-in-law. Unless something was going on, some kind of hanky-panky type production there.
I don't know about that. I mean, you could have a really good relationship with your sister-in-law. I don't think that's the wacky part.
Yeah, really good.
Okay. All right. but more, it is a little strange that he would name it after this river in Switzerland. And that kind of hints at the conflicted origin story, which is... A lot of claims are that he did not invent this. It was actually the invention of another man, an herbalist who was Swiss. That seems to make some more sense. Yeah, I mean, this guy was a businessman. You know, the Swiss herbalist whose name was Hans Kapler. You'd think an herbalist might know his way around herbal liqueur.
Right, and making it, and also that he was in Switzerland, where the river that is Suze is.
Well, so, he actually happened to live very close to the Suze River. And so, you know, his story is that he invented this. He originally called it Lore of the Alps, the Gold of the Alps, but then eventually, you know, redubbed it Suze. And basically he just fell on hard times. He was sick. He didn't have a lot of money. And in his desperation, he sold it to this Frenchman that was looking for a recipe to bring back to his newly inherited distillery that he needed to revive. So, you know, that's the true origin of it, which I think adding merit to this claim is the fact that there is an entire museum dedicated to Suze in the hometown of Swiss herbalist Hans Kapler. So,
well, and there is not one in France.
That is true. That is true.
Yeah, I think it's more believable that the herbalist did it and sold it to the businessman. That's the way those things work.
Which, yes. I mean, and you know, and there are other other tellings of the story that make that link. Like, yeah, this guy definitely invented it. Yeah, this guy absolutely bought it. And that he was, Fernand Moreau was open about that. Yes, I bought this. I brought it back and I made it. Why the Suze website chooses to kind of leave out the Swiss element of this, I'm not sure, but
yeah,
it seems like a fairly open secret that no, this other dude made it first. Maybe it's just less of a good story, right?
So there are so many Hatfield and McCoy stories in the drinking lore of all these different things where who did it first and they're battling. I mean, whether it's in the 40s or 50s with Don Beach and those guys with their tiki stuff, and then you got some of the other ones back there. It's just a lot of that goes on.
Well, you know, it makes sense why there are a lot of these sort of icons of the bartending world, the people that really got history written about them. You know, usually one of the first things you'll ever hear is like, oh, well, Jerry Thomas, he wrote things down. It's like, oh, so? It's like, oh, that's actually a big deal if you wrote things down.
Because nobody else did.
No, that's why there's all these wild claims, because no one was writing down. Write your drinks down. Write them down. That's Put your name on them. Make copies.
Mail it to yourself.
Yes. And maybe some friends. Well,
copyright,
you know,
it.
Whatever the origin story was, however it came about, Moreau presented Suze at the Universal Exhibition in 1889. You know, and he had this iconic tall brown bottle. It was designed by his business partner, who was Henri Porte. and it received honors and gold medals for it. Suze became incredibly popular in France and around Europe as well. Consumed on its own, over ice, was just the perfect answer to hot summer weather. It was just instantly beloved, sold amazingly, embedded itself in culture. It was further sort of propelled into popularity in 1912. Pablo Picasso immortalized a bottle of Suze in one of his paintings. It was the sponsor of the Tour de France in 1933 and then again in the 50s. It was reformulated slightly in 1945. It was made a little bit stronger and a little bit sweeter just to kind of keep up with the palate at the time. But it's otherwise, you know, been pretty much the same, and just it's made its claim in Europe. Took a while to get here.
Yeah, quite a while.
Yeah, it but was...
It rode that advertising wave that kind of came out around the same time when they were doing it, as like Guinness did, because Guinness forever said they weren't going to advertise because they didn't need to. If you make good enough beer, you don't need to. But then they did, and they really took off.
Well, and that's really why, you know, I wouldn't even if we do believe that, you know, that Hans Kapler was the creator of it, Fernand Moreau is still incredibly important to its story because he was a master of this advertising game, which really are these spirits, especially around this time period, that get really big, that become really just beloved for, you know, until now, they're still around.
Yeah.
Were the ones that took advantage of like the new sort of fascination with advertising that we got at the turn of the century there, end of 1800s, early 1900s, you know, getting famous artists to paint your bottle of booze, getting celebrities to be seen with it. This is kind of around the time period where those things were just in infancy and they were really powerful, and that, I mean, that's part of the product.
Yeah, it didn't do much good back in 186 BC or whatever, because you know, they didn't have commercials and you'd have to chisel out a billboard or something, and I don't think they'd do that.
Yeah, just like cave paintings, they're all just old alcohol advertisements.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's definitely, I don't think you can leave out the importance of that in the establishment.
It would have died with Kapler or whatever, you know, otherwise, possibly, if Moreau hadn't come along and done that.
Well, and also there are other smaller brands of gentian heavy digestifs, aperitifs that were created around this time. So Suze just sort of rose to the top because of this other element that it had. It's awareness of branding. That doesn't mean that it's not well made. It's a long process. They pick, like, they have a wild crop of gentian and like a farmed crop that's been around for centuries. They like take a minimum of 10 years for these plants to like reach the maturity that they use them for. They have it like macerate for a year. It's a very like long and articulate process to make Suze. So it is a quality product.
Well, that sounds pretty involved. I'll bet it's not cheap.
What is the bottle cost of a bottle of Suze? It's, you know, I just bought one. I feel like it might be in like the 30 to 40 range. But the thing is, it's one of those that like you're not going to use a lot of it. It's going to sit on your back bar and you're going to be able to use a half ounce in a drink and get as much flavor as you want from that. You know, in the white Negroni, you use a full ounce. But for the most part, it's a very dominant flavor because it is very bitter. It's just not as like heavy and syrupy as Campari can be.
So it'll last for a while.
Yeah, I think of it as like kind of an investment bottle, you know, like it's going to be useful. It's good to have. You're not going to need to replace it often. Oh, yeah. And it's like $30. So not anything like wildly expensive, but, you know.
Not like Grand Marnier or something.
Well, I mean, it's a little cheaper than those. I mean, but you know, Grand Marnier, I like having Grand Marnier on my shelf, but then I use a lot of it. I've had the same bottle of Suze. Like, I had a bottle for a long time. It not because I don't enjoy it. You just don't need to necessarily use that much of it. It's a powerful thing. I really do. Like, it is a good looking bottle. There are just some bottles that it's like, just, you know, like the Suze bottle, the Saint Germain bottle. I think the Campari bottle is very, the color palette is really beautiful. There's just certain bottles that like you just want to have there. You know, yeah. They just look nice.
They make your bar look better.
They do. They're just like, oh, you must be classy. You have so many nice bottles, even if you don't know what to do with them. They're so nice.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that's more or less the story of Seuss. It was not imported. It was not legally sold in America until 2012. So very recently.
Yeah. That was wild when I read that. I guess you could, you know, bartenders, they said that knew they had friends going overseas. They'd ask them to bring them back a bottle of this so they would have it. But I don't know if you could order it online or whatever. But that's wild that they didn't have a distributor bringing it here until 2012.
Well, yeah, I was sort of doing the math in my head, like, when did I first encounter it? Because I feel like it was before then. And like, oh, no, I've worked in bars that had Seuss, like, a dusty bottle on the back bar before then. But I feel like that was back in the wild days there's a little piracy going on.
Gotta make a trip to France to pick up some Seuss.
A little smuggling going on of Seuss. But yes, it's been around legally since 2012. And it also has... some other things. I mean, there's the original Seuss. They also have like a slightly higher ABV. I think it's also longer aged bottling. They also have a line of bitters, which is cool. They've kind of got their own version of an aromatic bitter, which is what we sort of think of when you see that term, it's sort of generically referencing Angostura because they don't want to doesn't always have to be Angostura. There are other bitters that do the same thing. They also have an orange bitter, and then they have a red. A red bitter. Fun. Maybe it's sort of paralleling like a, you know, you've got the holy trinity of bitters that you always use, which is Angostura, orange, and Peychaud's. So maybe it's kind of their nod at a Peychaud's. It's red.
Oh, I see.
I haven't come across their bitters yet, though.
Well, you know, they say imitation is the greatest form of flattery.
Well, you know. I'm sure they're quality products. And I love Seuss. I'm glad that I know more about it now. Now anybody that asks me that question is going to have to listen to me talk probably way more than they want to.
Well, I'm glad I know too. I hadn't even heard the words before, either one of them, Seuss or gentian.
Yeah, there you go.
You know, I would have just broken out into Seuss if they'd have said Seuss.
I mean, even now you are educated, you will still do that. That's true. Yeah. But no, it's a mid-range bottle, beautiful on your back bar, fun to play around with. You know, it's not one of those, it is a little bit more on the, if I had a scale of like Malort is on one end and I don't know, like, creme de cacao on the other, as far as like, if you buy a bottle of this, you're not gonna be mad at it. You can find something to do with it. It's tasty. Versus like, this is only for some people. I think like, you know, Seuss is sort of in the middle. Like, it's a little bit more distinct. It's got that hard bitterness to it, but it is very, it's very easy to work with, to add a little note to something. Not quite as likely to overtake your glass as some.
Malort will burn your taste buds off. You won't have any left to taste anything after you drink that.
No, and you know, Malort just shoves other bottles off the shelf. Like, you put Malort on your back bar, and all the other bottles are on the floor, and the Malort's just glaring at you.
Here, bartender, give me a shot of Malort. I hate me.
There is no back bar, only Malort. But you know, the simplest way to consume it, you can have it with soda. That's like a classic way, simple. You can have it in like sort of spritz preparation, and I would recommend the white Negroni. It's very nice, it's very refreshing. You know, if you're a fan of Negronis, or if you're not, it seems to please both kinds of people.
I said try it with tonic too, with the bitters. It works with the quinine type effect of the soda, so, or of the tonic. I said you would impress your bartender if you ordered something with it, if you saw it back there. I said, oh, this fellow knows about Seuss. Oh, the things you can think when you think about Seuss.
Now you have so many more things to think, and so does our audience. So if that sounds interesting to you, check it out. I also just think it's cool that you're drinking something that has like that people have been consuming some variation of it since so long ago, you know, like that is a weird little piece of our history there, the gingin.
And just like so many other things that we do, that they drink it straight in Europe or wherever it was founded, wherever it was invented, and we bring it here and mix it. We mix it with something. Yeah. How can we mix this? We're not going to drink it straight.
Fine. You can do both. It's, you know. But yeah, I will. Where videos are back, so we'll have a video up with Sue's. Not within a few days of this episode posting, so keep a lookout for that. Make some cocktails. Definitely make the white Negroni, but I'm excited to see if I can like find another well known one or just come up with something. And those are Patreon exclusive. So if you are a member of our Patreon, thank you so much. And if you're not, hey, for just $1 a month, you can have access to all of our videos. So if that interests you, go there, do that.
And rewards.
Yeah. Rewards just went out. If you didn't get them, but you should have by now. So, let me know.
Hit me up.
I always have some extra just in case something gets lost in translation. But, if you want to, find us elsewhere on the internet, we are, Neat Boozecast on Twitter and Instagram. We are neattheboozecast@gmail.com. If you want to email us, I love questions. So please do that. And if you want to talk about, Sue's or Genshin or Seussical the Musical, you can do that
at Neat the Boozecast group page on Facebook.
That's,
ta-da!
That is what it's for. All right.
I think I said all the words in the right order.
You did. That was good. It's great.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Dad, for being here.
Well, thank you, Tate, for having me. Always learn something, and I did again.
Me too. And of course, thank you all. I have been Taylor Smurl.
I've been Tommy Smurl.
And this has been
me. The things you can think, oh, the things you can think when you think about Seuss. Da 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 da. Seuss.
How much of that musical is just saying the word Seuss over and over again?
Probably not as much as I make it out to be.
Sounds like that's kind of the whole, that's the vibe.